Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and in these next two segments, we're going to be talking about the Right to Die movement and the euthanasia movement. This discussion is an extension of a long-running discussion that I've engaged in on the airwaves. It began in 1988 with a miscellaneous archive show dealing with euthanasia in contemporary Germany, in contemporary America, excuse me, and Nazi Germany. Just as fascism and Nazism themselves were no aberrations and grew out of Mussolini's concept of the corporate state, and just as the anti-communist and anti-labor stance of Nazism and fascism earned them the support of many of the most powerful industrialist financiers and corporations in the Western democracies, including and especially the United States, as documented in numerous archive shows, the first two RFA shows, RFA number 10, Uncle Sam and the Swastika, Uncle Sam and Il Duce, and others. So, too, the Nazi extermination programs and the racial laws and eugenics concepts from which they sprang were not an aberration either. The eugenics thinking and the eugenics laws were direct outgrowths of the international eugenics movement, which in turn were direct outgrowths of the international mental hygiene movement, and which gave rise to the international euthanasia movement. The Nazi racial laws began with their euthanasia program, as documented in the aforementioned archive show, Euthanasia in Nazi Germany and Contemporary America. Also, the miscellaneous archive show entitled The Seeds of Nuremberg, done in the spring of 1994. There's also a two-part segment entitled Fascism, Eugenics, and Euthanasia. All of these programs are available from Spitfire. If some of the supplemental discussion in the next two half-hour segments seems unintelligible, outrageous, what have you, I can appreciate that, so please get a hold of the aforementioned programs in order to flesh out your understanding. The Right to Die movement is something that is gaining steam in the United States, and in fact there are a number of key legal decisions now pending before the U.S. courts, and the Supreme Court will be dealing with this later on in the year. We should note that the Nazi extermination programs, as I've mentioned before, began with their T4, or Tiergartenstrasse 4 program. That was a program which initially began eliminating the terminally ill. It then went on to eliminate the chronically ill, the mentally ill, people with various disabilities. Finally, people who were simply too old and were not deemed worthy of serious medical care. And people who were otherwise deemed to be useless bread gobblers, as the Nazis put it. The actual legal door for the Nazi extermination programs began with the Naur case. That's K-N-A-U-E-R. I've dealt with that before. The Naur case involved a couple named Naur who had a horribly deformed child. That child was deformed in a number of ways, and the Naurs petitioned Hitler for the right to have that child put to sleep. That child was indeed put to sleep after an examination by Hitler's personal physician, Dr. Karl Brandt, who examined the child, recommended that the request be granted. Hitler signed that edict. This opened the door to the Nazi extermination programs. And again, their extermination programs began with their euthanasia program, and it was in the euthanizing centers that the people who were later to staff the death factories of Auschwitz, Treblinka, and so forth were trained and hardened to the act of killing innocent human beings. With a burdened economy, with the United States in a serious debt crisis as a result of the wasteful government spending of the Reagan and Bush years, and with the deindustrialization of the United States and the other industrial powers taking place as manufacturing facilities are moved to the Third World to take advantage of low labor costs and laxer environmental conditions, the worldwide problem of overcapacity, as well as America's debt situation, figures to overtake the industrialized world, and I am betting that there will be an economic collapse. I am afraid, I should say, that there will be an economic collapse in the not-too-distant future. Whether it's going to be in 6 months or 20 or 30 years, I do not know, but I'm afraid that in the event of an economic collapse, the pressure to dispose of unwanted human beings in the United States will increase. And it is against the background of the international euthanasia movement, the eugenics movement, which was rooted in many ways in the United States and which profoundly influenced the Nazi racial laws, the relationship between the Third Reich's euthanasia program and their subsequent extermination programs, and the failure of the world to come to terms with the fact that Nazism and fascism were not an aberration. The corporate state is very much with us today, and the profound support given by elements in the West to the Third Reich, both the industrialists and financiers, who were enamored of the anti-communist and anti-labor stance of Nazism, and the eugenicists, who were enamored of the racial laws of the Third Reich and who contributed in a profound way to those racial laws, none of these elements was sufficiently dealt with at the end of World War II. And again, we don't have time to go into this in any detail. I have dealt with this in other programs available from Spitfire. Village Voice columnist Nat Hentoff has been one of the very few to deal adequately with the issue of the Right to Die movement. And with Mussolini having defined fascism as corporatism, and that is precisely how Mussolini defined it, with Mussolini having defined his system, the fascist system, as the corporate state, and Mussolini was the first fascist and defined the term, and with the United States being dedicated to nothing if not corporatism and the corporate state in the year of our Lord, 1997, I think the lessons of the past about how the big oak of Auschwitz grew from the little acorn of the T4 program and the Naur case should be borne in mind and examined. Research credit on the following columns goes to a member of the listening audience. All of these columns are from the Village Voice. All of them are written by Nat Hentoff. This first Nat Hentoff column is entitled, We Hear the Death Train Coming, subtitled, Every One of Us Faces This Issue, Young and Old, Male and Female, and it reads in part as follows. Berlin, October 7th, 1933. The Ministry of Justice today announced its intention to authorize physicians to end the sufferings of incurable patients upon request in the interests of true humanity. That quote, by the way, was taken from the New York Times of October 8, 1933, reporting on the Nazi, quote, the Nazi aims regarding the German Penal Code, unquote. That quote again, because it's in many ways the key to this program. Berlin, October 7, 1933. The Ministry of Justice today announced its intention to authorize physicians to end the sufferings of incurable patients upon request in the interests of true humanity. And that again, New York Times, 8-8-1933. And below that is another quote, Helping people die is much cheaper and easier than providing them with care. If it becomes legal, patients will feel deep inside maybe they should opt for it. And that is a quote from Dr. Diane Meyer, M-E-I-E-R, Associate Professor of Geriatrics at Mount Sinai School of Medicine, quoted in the New York Daily News of January 12, 1997, and reacting to doctor-assisted suicide arguments before the Supreme Court. And indeed, I think Dr. Meyer has touched on the issue of corporatism as it applies to medical care, and indeed in 1997 with the HMOs applying in a very literal sense the doctrine of corporatism to medical care. I do not think the lessons of the T4 program, the eugenics movement, the euthanasia program in the United States, and Auschwitz are to be overlooked. Continuing with the Nat Hentoff column, that is to say, I think the euthanasia program in this country could, in the event of an economic collapse and resulting political catastrophe, lead to something like the extermination programs that took place in Germany. And indeed, in numerous shows available from Spitfire, we have already dealt with the very high probability that AIDS and quite possibly Ebola as well were deliberately created, resulting from the application of genetic engineering to the art of biological warfare. Continuing with this Nat Hentoff column from the Village Voice of February 4th, 1997. Margaret Mead, the enlivening anthropologist, often pointed out that before the 5th century B.C., when the doctor came calling, the patient was never sure whether he or she was going to be cared for or killed. Throughout the primitive world, she said, the doctor and the sorcerer tended to be the same person. He who had the power to cure would necessarily be able to kill, unquote. And an enemy of the patient could commission him to kill. Then came Hippocrates. For the first time in our tradition, Mead would say, there was a complete separation between killing and curing. But society always is attempting to make the physician into a killer. For instance, to kill the defective child at birth, it is the duty of society to protect the physician from such requests. Unquote. For the first time in this country's history, the Supreme Court is now being asked to erase the line between curing and killing. Will it legalize physician-assisted suicide and therefore euthanasia as well? It is the most profoundly dangerous question ever to be argued before the court. As Justice Sandra Day O'Connor said, quote, This is an issue every one of us faces, young and old, male and female, unquote. If the Supreme Court decides that doctors can legally help terminally ill patients kill themselves, the decision will also affect generations to come. Those pushing for the reversal of Hippocrates' legacy, including the American Civil Liberties Union and the Hemlock Society, speak of assisted suicide as synonymous with compassion and death with dignity. Yet, during oral arguments, Justice David Souter laid out the fears of Dr. C. Everett Koop and other opponents. Quote, "The practice of assisted suicide is going to gravitate down to those who are not terminally ill, to those, in fact, who have not made a truly voluntary or knowing choice. And ultimately, it's going to gravitate into euthanasia," unquote. I would add that is precisely what happened in Nazi Germany. It is why I am citing some of the corporatist and eugenics antecedents of fascism and Nazism here in the United States in the context of the growing push in the United States to institute physician-assisted suicide, something which is very likely to escalate or to gravitate, as Dr. Koop put it, into euthanasia. And that, with a corporatist approach and in the event of an economic collapse and resulting political crisis, I think may very well lead to the pressure to dispose of large numbers of people. Indeed, it is my contention that this country is now disintegrating into fascism and that we are in the process of going down the same road Germany went down. Continuing with this Nat Hentoff column. Quiet as it's been kept in the print and broadcast press, both the Ninth Circuit and Second Circuit cases now before the Supreme Court have already come out for euthanasia as well as assisted suicide. Under certain circumstances, those courts say, a doctor may directly administer a lethal injection to patients incapable by themselves of taking deadly drugs given to them by physicians assisting suicide. Someone with Lou Gehrig's disease, for instance. That's direct killing. That's euthanasia. Incompetent, non-communicative patients, say the Ninth and Second Circuits, can also be killed if approval is given by a surrogate, a member of the family, or a lawyer. Or a severely brain-damaged child can be put to death by a doctor with permission of a surrogate if the child is diagnosed as terminally ill. Yet how precise are such diagnoses of the end of life? A considerable number of people, once diagnosed as ready to be measured for a coffin within weeks, are still alive. And skipping down, Nat Hentoff here quotes a woman named Lucy Gwynn, editor of Mouth Magazine, which is billed as the voice of disability rights, unquote. By the way, the disabled were among the early victims of the T4 program in Germany. Skipping down and continuing, quoting Lucy Gwynn, Hentoff writes, quote, "I suspect they want to be able to get rid of old mom if she becomes too drooly and incoherent, and this is a nice, liberal, ACLU-sanctioned way to do it," unquote. "I once thought the ACLU was the most valuable organization in the country, but I see now that if you're disabled or very ill, but not only terminally ill, or getting too old, or you're an infant infected with HIV, you're not on the ACLU's list of priorities." Skipping down. Also examining the scope of what the ACLU and other hasteners of death desire is Dr. Nancy Dickey, D-I-C-K-E-Y, a family physician in Richardson, Texas, and board chair of the American Medical Association. If doctors become accomplices in suicides or do the killing themselves, quote, "a huge number of patients," she says, "will be at risk. Among them, quote, patients who have less access to good pain treatment and palliative care. The groups at highest risk are the elderly, the poor, the less educated, and women," unquote. Dr. Dickey, in an interview with the American Medical News, made the crucial point that singling out a group of people, the purportedly terminally ill, as having, quote, "lives not worth living," unquote, can lead sooner rather than later to no longer protecting patients who are not terminally ill, quote, "just chronically ill, maybe just expensively chronically ill," unquote. And bear in mind that fascism is corporatism, as Mussolini said, and that we here in the United States in 1997 are seeing, via the HMOs and others, the direct application of a corporatist philosophy to health care. Continuing. "Should the court agree with the acolytes of death, the legal right to assisted suicide will be," she says, that's Dr. Dickey, "the first, quote, treatment," unquote, "to which American patients have a constitutional right." In the New York Times, bioethicist Arthur Kaplan adds, quote, "To have the right to die before you have the right to treatment seems a little backward. We may end up saying, quote, we've got assisted suicide. We don't have to worry about fixing up the pathetic nursing home system for the frail, old, and disabled. they can kill themselves if they don't like it, unquote. Next week, Dr. Timothy Quill, the poster for the Right to Die movement, and a deep look down the slippery slope. Now, this next Nat Hentoff column from the following week, namely February 11th of 1997, does indeed discuss Dr. Timothy Quill, who has become one of the leading and most respected advocates for physician-assisted suicide. Now, I want to stress in this discussion that I'm not in any size, shape, form, or manner impugning Dr. Quill's motives. I don't know the gentleman, and his motives may very well be well-intended. However, it's worth noting that the whole issue of physician-assisted suicide is larger than any individual, and that regardless of his motivation, we are already seeing in some of the rhetoric of Dr. Quill over a period of time the same willingness to extend the physician-assisted suicide to the notion of getting rid of others as well. And it is just this sort of a gravitation or escalation that in Nazi Germany led to the Nazi extermination programs. And bear in mind, the forces that gave rise to Hitler, both intellectually, politically, and economically, are anything but alien to the United States, hence my noting that, and hence my fears about physician-assisted suicide. Village Voice, February 11th, 1997, Nat Hentoff, the poster doctor for euthanasia, subtitled, "The New Way to Treat the Suffering Patients is to Kill Them." And again, I'm not, in reading this, impugning Dr. Quill's motives. But note the willingness to escalate here. On 60 Minutes, Ed Bradley described Dr. Timothy Quill as the, quote, "well-respected, mild-mannered physician," unquote, who wants doctor-assisted suicide to be legalized. The Baltimore Sun, in an admiring portrait, said that Quill is one of the nation's, quote, "most eloquent spokesman for relieving the suffering of the terminally ill," unquote. Dr. Quill, a professor of medicine and psychiatry at the University of Rochester and associate director of medicine at the Genesee Hospital, is also a general practitioner. He became a national figure in 1991 when he wrote an article for the New England Journal of Medicine on how he agreed to help a patient with acute leukemia end her life by giving her lethal pills. Quill made clear that this was not a quick Kevorkian-style mercy killing. The woman had been a patient of Quill's for a long time, and he made sure that she was rational and not clinically depressed when she longed for death. After much conversation, he gave her the pills, but was not present when she took them. The article was widely discussed within and outside the medical profession, all the more so when Quill testified before a grand jury investigating the death. He was not indicted. The grand jurors believed in his good faith. Quill, as is evident from the very respectful way in which he was treated by the press, can be compellingly persuasive. He keeps emphasizing that for a doctor to deliberately quicken death at the patient's request requires a long-term, intimate knowledge of the patient's psychological as well as physical history. A few years ago, I was on a panel with Dr. Quill and found him slippery. He didn't like me either. This year, Quill is a protagonist in one of two Supreme Court cases that may fundamentally change how and when people, including you, die. The case, which will be decided by June or early July, are Vacco versus Quill and the State of Washington versus Glucksberg. At the core of both cases is whether physicians should have the right to help patients commit suicide. Also at issue is the corollary right of doctors to directly kill the legally incompetent, as, for example, the severely mentally retarded, Alzheimer's patients, and defective children. Giving a lethal injection to a patient is committing euthanasia. In opposition to Quill and other lethally compassionate physicians is Dr. Catherine Foley, F-O-L-E-Y, co-chief of the Pain and Palliative Care Service of the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York. Foley, the nation's leading expert in pain management, points out that many doctors around the country know far too little about how to deal with intense pain, and that many medical schools are deficient in educating doctors about pain management. Dr. Foley, speaking of the two cases before the Supreme Court, emphasizes that the preliminary circuit court decisions, which supported assisted suicide, quote, devalue the dying patient and their caregiver, and in the name of compassion, have developed a postmodern view of the treatment of suffering, which is to kill the sufferer, unquote. Although Foley has been given some press attention, including on National Public Radio, much of the focus has been on mild-mannered, gentle Timothy Quill and his position that assisted suicide should be reserved only for the acutely suffering terminally ill, whose doctors must have known those patients long and well. Also, he says, sending a patient into eternity this way should be a rare event. Those who object to Quill's concept of medicine emphasize that once killing a patient is legal, it will not stop at the terminally ill. Falling down the slippery slope will be people who are chronically ill, who do not have access to doctors who can manage pain, and who are disabled with a, quote, quality of life, unquote, that repels many doctors. In fact, however, Dr. Timothy Quill is the very model of a true believer that the slippery slope is good for you, despite what he says on television and in press interviews. In April of 1996, Quill appeared before the House Subcommittee on the Constitution. The chairman, Charles Kennedy, C-A-N-A-D-Y, and I may be mispronouncing that, noted that in 1991, Quill had said that assisted suicide was to be a rare, quote, last resort, unquote, for the terminally ill. Just for the terminally ill. However, Kennedy said to Quill, quote, in 1992, you wrote that assisted suicide should also be available to people with, quote, incurable but not immediately terminal progressive diseases such as ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease, or multiple sclerosis, unquote. Those two diseases, as Richard Dorflinger of the National Conference of Catholic Bishops, an expert on assisted suicide, notes, are, quote, two of Dr. Jack Kevorkian's most common indications for death, unquote. But in the press, the dignified Dr. Quill is presented as the direct opposite of the out-of-control Kevorkian. Congressman Kennedy continued to probe Quill's dangerous inconsistencies. Kennedy addressed Quill, reminding the doctor that, quote, in 1994, you said we must allow physicians to give lethal injections or we would, quote, unfairly discriminate against patients with unrelievable suffering who resolve to end their lives but are physically unable to do so, unquote. Quill had moved down the slope from assisted suicide for terminal patients to killing people with Lou Gehrig's disease and multiple sclerosis. Now the mild-mannered doctor was sliding still farther down the slope and advocating direct lethal injections by physicians. There's more. Richard Dorflinger, D-O-E-R-F-L-I-N-G-E-R, one of the best researchers I know, shows that Quill now sees, quote, an intolerable quality of life, unquote, as the chief indication for assisted suicide. Not only intolerable pain, but, quote, the prospect of dying in an undignified, unaesthetic, absurd, and existentially unacceptable condition justifies the practice in his eyes, unquote. What a vague, overbroad, and subjective criterion for killing a patient, and, quote, existentially unacceptable condition, unquote. Congressman Kennedy asked Dr. Quill how he explains his lethal inconsistencies. Well, said Quill, he was only exploring, quote, these issues at an intellectual level, unquote. But right now, unquote, said Quill, again quoting, we should restrict this practice as the last resort for terminally ill patients, unquote. Asked Kennedy, you have gone back to your 1991 position, as opposed to what you expressed in 1992 and 1994, unquote, said Quill. I think for the current situation, yes, unquote. And Hentoff goes on to add, let's not frighten the Supreme Court justices with euthanasia until they've made their decision about assisted suicide. And again, if this appears off the wall, just bear in mind the various archive shows that I've done, again, discussing the corporatist nature of fascism, the profound assistance and decisive assistance given to Hitler and Mussolini by Western industrialists, financiers, and corporations, and the profound influence on the Nazi racial laws, which led to the Nazi extermination programs of American eugenics thinking and legislation, thinking and legislation which persists to this day in the form of such organizations as the Pioneer Fund. And again, some of the archival references for people who would like to pursue this information further with regard to eugenics and the Nazi T4 or euthanasia program, which led directly to the Third Reich's extermination programs, including a discussion of the Nauer case, the euthanizing of a horribly deformed infant, which opened the door in Nazi Germany for state-authorized legal killing. The miscellaneous archive show from March of 1988 entitled Euthanasia in Nazi Germany and Contemporary America. Also the Seeds of Nuremberg program from the spring of 1994. With regard to the corporatist connections of fascism, the Uncle Sam and the Swastika program, Uncle Sam and Il Duce, American support for Mussolini and the mythology of the corporate state, the first two RFA shows, RFA number 10, and the miscellaneous archive show about Japanese fascism, as well as half-hour segments from Spitfire entitled Il Martello, the Roots of the Cold War, and a tribute to George Seldes. All of these go into the corporatist connections to fascism. Spitfire, by the way, is a tape duplication service which stocks all of the half-hour segments that I've produced, all of the various interviews that I've done, as well as many of the lectures that I've done. They are now stocking the archive shows as well. You can contact Spitfire with the following address. Spitfire can be reached at Post Office Box 1179, P.O. Box 1179. That is in Ben Lomond, California, capital B-E-N, capital L-O-M-O-N-D, zip code 95005. There's also an email address, A-L-C-A-L-A-M-E, that's A-L-C-A-L-A-M-E, at ix.netcom.com. That address again, A-L-C-A-L-A-M-E, at ix.netcom.com. The regular mail address, Spitfire, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E, one word, P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005. That concludes this segment. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.